Jamaica, an island nation of less than 3 million people, famous for its vibrant imagination and invention. And what underpins that imagination and invention is Rastafari. The red, gold and green colours are everywhere.
Rasta did everything for Jamaica. Rasta put Jamaica on the map.
It's the idea of resistance to oppressive systems that have held back people through the process of brainwashing and slavery.
For me, it is not a religion, but for me, it is a political way of life. It is a statement. It is a confirmation and an affirmation of my Pan-African spirituality.
Rastafari is like the architect of Jamaica.
Through reggae music, in just a few decades, Rastafari has become the very soul of Jamaica.
Rastafari!
Alongside Bob Marley, Rastafari is Jamaica's most famous export. This cultural and spiritual movement defines the shape of the nation. The colours, the dreadlocks, reggae music, and of course, marijuana, for better or for worse, have become the Jamaican image. My name is Kingsley Daly, better known as Akala. I'm a poet, rapper, and founder of the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company. I was born in London, and my dad and all the elder men in my life pretty much were Rastas. I grew up surrounded by this culture, and it's been a cornerstone of my upbringing. Welcome to Roots, Reggae and Rebellion. I've come to Jamaica to talk to the people to whom this culture means the most.
Reggae music is naturally a direction, in positive way, to Rastafari.
To fool the black population, not telling them that judge.
My whole life growing up, I was always surrounded by Rasta ideology and symbology, from reggae music to sound systems to my godfather, my uncles, my father, etc. It's been such an influence on my life. And now we are here almost at ground zero, the foundation point, the start of the whole story. Just outside of Kingston, a place called Pinnacle, which is the site of the very first Rasta settlement founded by Leonard Howe back in the 1930s.
Yeah, man.
Yes, sir, yes.
Come on,
man. I wish you could see right now the view I can see. Like, we can basically see the whole of Jamaica. We're at the top of a hill, and it must be one of the highest points in Jamaica.
Yeah, man.
When Pinnacle was founded, what kind of lifestyle would people lead?
Well, they would lead, for the most part, communal lifestyle, but several families would have their own holdings. And some would live in a common area, like dormitory. But you have a central economy based on building shoes and building brooms and building various handicraft and craftwork. And many different crafts were engendered among the people and taught by people who came in as master craftsmen. Mm-hmm. But a lot of food supply for the urban markets was supplied from places like this. And the growing of ganja was another key element in that economy. So even later years, after they mash up Pinnacle and he had to move away, he still lived a fairly independent life.
Mm-hmm. When you say they mashed up Pinnacle, what happened?
The government, many times police raided the place, mash up the buildings, destroy the crops, arrest people, carry them off, divide families, beat people, kill people. Mm-hmm. Several raids through the 40s. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one was in 1954, and it was almost completely destroyed.
Like Bongo Jerry Small, speaking then, most Rastas know the fate of Pinnacle, the first Rasta camp. In the 1940s and 50s, Pinnacle was considered a stronghold of rebellion by the colonial authorities. As blacks sought to have economic independence from their white colonial masters, there were several attempts to break up the camp, and according to some reports, many Rastas were arrested, beaten, and even killed. These stories are seared onto the imagination of Jamaica. Japul is from London. He moved to Pinnacle a few years ago with his wife and children and has been absorbing its history from the elders.
3,000 people lived up here. They had brick houses and running water pipes and everything. Mm. And when the police came up here, they came and brought their houses with sledgehammers. Mm. Even the youths have the idea of seeing the police come and beating their mothers up and even, you know, have sex with them and all this. Yeah, in front of the youths. I'm talking a big man. He'd be telling me these things that happen, you know, to his family. And, you know, he's seen his dad get punched and hit with the mallet.
Until Rastafari was popularized worldwide by Bob Marley in the 1970s, this black religious movement struggled to fit in with Jamaican society. Indeed, most of the movement's followers feel Rastafari is still marginalized even today. That's despite what Rastafarians see as billions of dollars being brought into the country by Rasta influence through reggae music, tourism, and through its imagery and fashion. I personally have seen Bob Marley memorabilia all over the globe. Even this original Rastafari heritage site is seemingly unprotected. Rastafari emerged in the 1930s in colonial era Jamaica, developing out of the anger over the treatment of people of African heritage by the British colonial authorities. It's a melding of the Old Testament and the teachings of the Jamaican Pan-Africanist Marcus Garvey, heard speaking here on a recording from 1921.
We hear the cry of England for the Englishman, of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Japan for the...
Garvey proclaimed in the 1920s,
"Look to Africa, when a black king shall be crowned. The day of deliverance is near."
When the Ethiopian prince, Rastafari, whose name was Haile Selassie I, became emperor in 1930, the descendants of enslaved Africans in Jamaica took this as proof that Garvey's prophecy had come to pass. The fact that Selassie was also a Pan-Africanist, with black empowerment philosophies of his own, only further cemented their belief. Many Rastafari believe Selassie to be the second coming of Jesus, a black Christ. But whatever the theologies surrounding Rastafari, its importance for Jamaica and for the Jamaican diaspora has gone way beyond religion. At the Calabash Literary Festival in St. Elizabeth, 3 hours from Kingston, I went to explore the hinterlands of Jamaican music and culture. Festival organizer Kwame Dawes was there to meet.
That'll be followed by a first opening mic. By the way, I want to thank, I really want to thank Karen Cooper for the fantastic job she's doing with the open mic. Let's hear it for her.
Calabash is a literary festival that is modeled on what we think is a core aesthetic in Jamaican culture, which would be reggae music. Reggae is the music that is thoroughly local and finds its grounding in the Jamaican culture and landscape, and yet has had incredible international presence and authority.
Looking at this culture, this reggae culture, where does Rastafari sit in the cultural landscape of Jamaica?
I think sometimes people mistake the idea that it began in the 1930s. I think Rasta's origin lies in a long history of Afrocentric engagement in Judeo-Christianity, and that goes way back during the period of slavery. And the roots of reggae and the roots of Rastafarianism are within that space. What we've learned from Rasta and how it shaped reggae music is the idea of invention and reinvention of self. It's the idea of resistance to oppressive systems that have held back people through the process of brainwashing and so on. Rasta made the proposition that what if God was a black man from Ethiopia? What does that do to the world? And I think Rasta talk was deconstructing English and saying, you know, using the I, for instance, the I and I, and then the Ipa and Ilalu, and everything becomes that I, or the deconstruction of language where downpressor replaces oppressor and so on, which may have seemed funny, but what they were actually doing was challenging the political ideas of language. What you see Rasta doing is producing a very Caribbean idea of reinvention.
Welcome them in the rich and beautiful way that we can. Salman Rushdie, Paul Woodgrave.
Tell you, This is incredible. There's...
Most writers will tell you that any kind of subculture is always interesting because it's kind of novelistic in shape. That's really why so many works of drama as well as literature are set in places like hospitals or police stations or schools, because you've got this kind of mini universe, and in that mini universe you can see reflections of the greater universe. And I think that's true of any, I mean, it's true of Rastafarianism as well. You know, you can look at this as a subculture, and in it you can see reflections of larger themes, you know. So,
how do you view Rastafari as a religion, as a political system?
I'm the wrong person to ask about religion. No, I mean, I'm interested in it as a culture out of which has come a lot of work that I admire, whether it's film or music or writing. I look at it in that way. And I mean, I do think if you start unpacking religions, you can find ridiculous things in all of them. The idea of Rastafari, Haile Selassie, actually being some kind of divine figure is, to someone of my temperament, that's absurd. But you have to look at it in a less literal way, I think, because I don't think people are looking at it quite that literally anymore.
As Salman Rushdie said, Rastafari's influence is way more than just religious, to such an extent that to focus only on the religious part of its doctrine would be to miss much of the movement's role and strengths. I caught up with Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, the great Kenyan novelist, who has long recognised the Pan-African connection between Jamaica and Kenya. Marcus Garvey was a massive influence on the Kenyan independence struggle, and it is also rumoured that the origins of the wearing of dreadlocks comes from the Mau Mau Kenyan independence fighters. He has also recognised Rasta as something that helped to decolonise the minds and culture of Jamaica's people.
The arts, from reggae to dances, are part also of the decolonizing process, because sometimes you have to have an image of something before you can fight it out, right?
What do you mean by that? Well, you have to have an image of someone before you can fight out?
Human beings, we are always drawing pictures of the world around which we live. We have a mental picture, okay, of the world we live in. We have a mental picture of our own history, of everything we do. Now, the colonial process interferes with the freedom of that image formation. So the image is, in a way, is everything. And the music, the arts in general, they really help us to form mental images of the world.
I think what Ngugi says is a key part of understanding this spiritual concept. The striking out symbols of clothes, hair, colour, and music conceal and contain a set of powerful and pervasive ideas. For Arlene McKenzie from Montego Bay's Rastafari Indigenous Village, Rasta's ability to inhabit the mind takes the struggle way back into the colonial history, well before Selassie, Garvey, and even the 1930s.
You have to sit down to deconstruct the lies that have been told to you. And in the Caribbean, you know, you're told our history starts with slavery. Mm. And really, that is where we have been learning, and we have to change all of that to say that's not where our history starts. Our history starts long before. You know, from the beginning of time, all the rebellions that was taking place. Who were these people?
As colonized people, I think we were socialized to think of ourselves as British. Believe it or not, that is how people from all over the Commonwealth came to think of England as a mother country.
Professor Carolyn Cooper is head of the Literary and Cultural Studies Department at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica.
This idea of claiming a black identity was really not part of the colonial ideology of turning us into good imitators of British culture, so that there's a generation of West Indians who try to sound as English as possible, you know, cultivating a British accent. And the whole embodiment of the colonial subject was looking to England for a sense of identity. And it was Garvey, Rastafari, reggae musicians who said, no, let us look to Africa.
Africa.
about politically, you know, this idea of prioritizing an African identity over what was perceived as maybe in some ways a colonial
Jamaican identity. Well, it was a moment, wasn't it? I mean, it has to do with the phenomenon of decolonization, which was all over the world. Mm. You know, and there were different forms of decolonizing rhetoric that were used in different places, you know, so that in parts of Africa, Islam played that role. And actually, in parts of the United States at the time of the Black Muslim movement, you know, the way of defining yourself against white culture was to step towards this other belief system. And here, clearly, this is the local variation of that theme.
From a 2014 perspective, Salman Rushdie can see the central role which Rastafarian culture had in the 20th century's global civil rights struggle. But it's important to remember that back in the 1950s and 60s, Rastafari was very much on the fringes of Jamaican society. In a century where the tailored suit clothed both the politician and preacher alike, Rastafari never compromised on an appearance which subverted these norms. Long dreadlocked hair, taking pride in your black skin, and a stronger reverence for the natural world than the corporate. After Jamaica endured centuries of British colonial rule, British imagery, Christianity, and a very white sensibility became the norm for most Jamaicans. So the very unconventional look of Rastafarians was a shock to Professor Carolyn Cooper as a child on the streets of her hometown.
As a high school student in Jamaica in the 60s, that is when you became aware of the beard men. Who are quite frightening. You know, I remember, you know, walking down the street and if you see a Rasta man approaching across the road because they were seen as dread, as in dreadful, mm-hmm. as in frightening. So they became symbols of what was not acceptable, the locking of the hair. So it was really an assertion of a black body in a way that acknowledged roots, literally your hair roots.
Arlene McKenzie.
Even today, a man walking the street dragging his foot on the ground with his matted locks, uncombed hair. Everybody fears it because it is so close to our history. And if you think about the Coral Gardens incident, which was a massacre of the Rastafari in Montego Bay, which is round them up and bring them in dead or alive. Mm. You know, these people with matted hair who are against the norms in the society. The Coral Gardens was a reality. People were massacred. People were killed, arrested for smoking ganja.
So we're just walking through Calabash and we've happened upon an Ital food stall, which means proper, healthy food, run by a group of Rastas from St. Mary's. And here's a guy we're told is called Bongo Steve. He's a very significant member of the Rasta community. And we're certainly alive in the late 60s, early 70s, so let's see what he knows about the events that we're interested in.
I am 76 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a testament to Ital food, isn't it? So what made you turn to Rasta? What was it that connected with you?
During the year of President Kennedy being killed and the Black Panthers and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and we came very black conscious in mind. All that I learned in the black movement in America and came here, I just put it together and, oh, that is what Rastafari means. Mm. Black consciousness, you understand me? Global consciousness, that's what he meant to me.
Talk to me about Coral Gardens. Assume that people have never heard of that. What was Coral Gardens?
In 1963, the Afternoon Star newspaper said, bring in all Rastas dead or alive. I found out that one of my schoolmates was killed. I took the train, the diesel from Kingston, and went all the way to Montego Bay and was walking back to Mount Salem, where I usually stay when I come to Montego Bay. And a lorry load of soldiers swarmed down on me at Creek Street near the dome and questioning me, where you coming from? What you doing? So, because at that time, I always had my beard and always had a afro. So any bearded man or anyone like that would be, you know, called up.
And so were you arrested in the end?
I was arrested but taken to the police station, you know. So I wasn't beaten like many other Rastas. So a lot of people were killed. That was it. That was Coral Gardens.
Bongo Steve lived through the 11th of April 1963, when in Montego Bay, eight people were killed and many others injured when Rastas clashed with the Jamaican Constabulary Force at Coral Gardens. Today, many Rastas see the event as a defining moment for them at a time when they were struggling for a chance to express their ideas and culture without oppression from the state. Back then, Alexander Bustamante, the first Prime Minister of Jamaica, and a white man, had publicly expressed his wish to see all Rastas sent to the cemetery. If even the Prime Minister viewed Rastafari with such violent distrust, it's amazing to think of how it achieved international recognition just a decade later. If there's one person who made that possible, more than any other, it's the man who over 30 years after his death is arguably the most famous musician on the planet and certainly the most well-known Rastafari. Marley biographer, Kwame Dawes.
Bob Marley's music is religious music. In any other context, we'd call him a gospel singer.
Reggae music is a way of life, man. Reggae music is naturally direction, in positive way, to Rastafari.
But this is a gospel that speaks to the social circumstances of life. And this is a gospel that is psalmic. It is the Davidian idea of the individual holding faith and articulating for the people and themselves. And if you go through all of music, that combination is rare. What he gave us was a combination of a public articulation through a very lyric and personal expression of it. Because Bob Marley is fundamentally a Rasta.
Well, Rastafari is my life. I live Rastafari, and you know, it's a way to life, because the other road is dead.
In Kingston, Jamaica, on Hope Road, is Bob Marley's house, which is now a museum to the musical legend. I popped in to have a look around and found one of his sons, Julian Marley, holding court with some friends.
Our father, you know, gave us that understanding from songs. Any word when we listen about my father, I can learn something about Rastafari. Our thing is all about Africa, and the whole world is Africa, but it's a consciousness, which is unity and oneness, you know what I mean? So to know that our father was a part of liberation, I mean, you know. It's...
So does that make you see Rastafari as a religion, a spiritual system, or a political, or all of it?
Life, living, the way to live, like.
Every man you see us are gangites, you know?
What does that mean when you say you're a gangite?
That means Bob Marley's songs and words become philosophy to us. What he sing about become the bedrock of our living.
And why has Rastafari become the dominant image of Jamaica around the world?
This is where the first wisdom came to take to the world. And it was ordained by the Almighty, that's all we can say. So we cannot answer beyond that part, but you know, this is where, I don't know, for some reason.
But why? That's what I want to try and get. Why Jamaica? You know, there's so many other places in the African diaspora with similar history.
Probably coming back from even a longer tradition of how we even reached to Jamaica. So maybe that knowledge came with us here for some reason. So, but it got lost, but it got found.
So as we know, with Julian's father at the center, roots reggae exploded in the 1970s. Bob Marley became a global superstar. Other Rastafarian acts like Peter Tosh and Burning Spear became international stars too. Their songs very publicly carrying the message of Rastafari. So just a decade after the brutality of something like Coral Gardens in 1972, hopeful future Prime Minister Michael Manley aligned himself with Rastafarian singers like Marley and Max Romeo to help his political campaign. 6 years later, at a time of great civil unrest, it was Bob Marley who stemmed escalating violence. By 1978, Jamaica's opposing parties, the JLP and the PMP, were literally at war. Gun battles raged on the streets of Kingston. Marley himself had even been shot in his own home. But at the 1978 One Love Peace Concert, Bob Marley was able to diffuse the tension by joining the hands of the leaders of the warring political parties, Michael Manley and Edward Seaga, on stage in front of thousands with a Rastafari message of peace. perhaps pop music's most powerful political gesture. Rastafari had officially forced itself into the mainstream of Jamaican society. Professor Carolyn Cooper, reggae historian.
Reggae music was seen as a means through which the message of Rasta was spread. And so the music catapulted Rastafari onto the global stage.
And how do you think that changed Jamaica too?
By forcing Jamaicans see themselves as black and having an African diaspora consciousness. Mm. And I think that is the essence of reggae, creating a black space. And that is also what Rastafari did.
And it was this black space that British-born black people and Jamaican immigrants attempted to create in London and the rest of the UK via Rastafari. People like my father and his friends. In the next program, I'll be exploring Rasta's role in Britain and I'll be discovering the place that it holds in Jamaica today.